Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, coming to you live as I do every Thursday night, 8 p.m. New York time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight, we're going to take a deeper look at the societies we analyze through the cycles of change or anyone or any way by sharing a special journey that has been taken by tonight's special guest, Rennie Vidmore, who has traveled around the world in ways that few have imagined. We're talking about sailing from New York to London area and his most recent sojourn, where he traveled through 15 countries in Europe in a boat that he built in his backyard. He gives us a unique perspective on societies from his travels. This 15 and a half foot boat that he built was what he used to travel the waterways, the byways, to see the parts of Europe that he recently visited and wound up in the Mediterranean. His worldly travels lets him see things from a different points of view, which is essential if we are to understand any aspect of a nation, including the rhythms of change. Rennie also runs his site design program and development company called Rennie Vidmore NS Limited. It has won graphic awards that are almost too numerous to count, from the New York Art Directors Club, One Show, numerous Clio Awards, AIGA, Andy, CA, as well as numerous computer game awards. His company has contracted for CBS, NBC, HBO, ABC, E.F. Hutton, Cosmopolitan Magazine, and more and more. I just haven't listed them all in the description because the description would become lengthy. I asked Rennie to come on and share the perspective of his journeys because I felt as though I was sort of identifying with him when I learned of the travels he had, even though they're the type of travels that I myself have not been on. Why? Because he has done on the physical level what I tried to do on the virtual level, which is to travel the byways and see the inside of a society in a way that sometimes few have. When you're going to look at the cycles of change in the world, you have to understand what is changing. And you find that it is us that is changing, you have to understand what is us. This has led me to seek out people who know more than I do, who have experiences that I haven't had. And I was delighted when I came across Rennie Vidmore. He has a true traveling pioneer spirit. He has a craftsmanship, and he is a unique individual. So I'm very pleased to announce that Rennie is going to share his tales with us tonight. Rennie, are you there?
I am. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Rennie. Thank you for joining us tonight. And I was telling folks a little bit about your amazing Rennie Vidmore NS Limited company. But before we get to any of that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your most recent journey that you did through Europe. Rennie, can you tell me a little bit about this boat that you built in your backyard?
I didn't set off to actually build a boat. I didn't think that that was going to happen because I don't have any experience of building boats. But I thought to myself, I would like to go do a little exploring on the Chesapeake in a small boat, and I came across some plans for a very simple, almost rowboat kind of plywood boat that a fellow out in Michigan designed, and he was selling plans for a very little bit of money, and I thought, why don't I buy these plans and look at them? If this boat's as simple to build as it looks like it may be, then I'll take the next step. So I bought the plans for very little money and looked them over and thought, how many times have I heard people say that they were going to build a boat and would get halfway through the project and abandon it?
Mm.
Well, and I thought that could very well happen to me, too, because I didn't really know what I was going to be in for. But since I had the plans, I built a little model. And the model only took me a weekend. And I built the model the way, directly according to the plan. So I thought, oh, hell, if I can build a model, maybe I can build a real thing. And about 8 or 9 months later, out of my cellar, I dragged a 15-foot flat-bottom skiff, very much like the kind of a boat that you see pulled up on the beach with the oarlocks taken out by the local fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And although this boat was designed for calm waters, very well-protected waters, I had talked to the designer of the boat, and he said, this is a lake boat, you know. This is for nice sunny days with hardly a ripple on the surface, because it's just not designed for rough water.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, okay, but I like the lines so much. And by the way, although this boat has the lines of a little fishing skiff, it has a little cuddy cabin, which was obviously essential.
Yeah.
Just enough room for me to stretch out in with a sleeping bag and a foam mattress. Anyway, it all came to pass little by little, and I adopted a Japanese method that we learned from the Japanese called just in time, where you, if I needed a new piece of plywood, I would buy just that. I knew I was going to need another 7 pieces of plywood, but heck, maybe this boat was not meant to happen. So I'll just buy that 1 piece of plywood, work it into the boat, and then go on to the next. So anyway, so the boat finally did get completed. I did take it down to the Chesapeake Bay. I live in northern Pennsylvania, so it wasn't too far away. And she floated, and she didn't sink, and she handled the Chesapeake Bay quite nicely, much better than I expected she would.
Indeed. And what set your sights on taking this boat across the ocean to travel in Europe?
Well, this was 3 or 4 years ago that I built this little thing, and I took her originally down to the Gulf of Mexico and back, and then I took her up the Hudson and through the Great Lakes to Chicago, down Lake Michigan to Chicago, and then down the Mississippi and various other waterways back to the Gulf, around to Florida and back up again. So I had pretty much covered the eastern coast of the eastern parts of states.
Yeah,
and so I set my sights on Europe. I had many years ago in a much larger boat, an ocean-going boat, done some canals in France, and I thought they were so beautiful, so gorgeous, that I thought I'd like to try that again, only this time in a little boat, you know, just adequate. So at any rate, I happened in conversation with a very close friend, say, you know, I'd really like to do the French canals. He said, why do the French canals? I got a friend who ships boats over, speedboats over to Russia. And why don't you go sail the Baltic? And so I said, okay. So I talked to his friend, and we shipped this little 15-footer over to, actually, we didn't ship it to Russia. I was wanted to ship it to St. Petersburg, but the Russians were giving me a hard time about allowing this little 15-foot boat in. I don't know what they thought it was, maybe a ship. Anyway, I had a ship to Finland, and right on the Russian border.
Uh-huh.
I set out from there, and 3.5 months later, I wound up in southern Spain.
Wow.
Now, having gone through, covered the Baltic Sea from Finland across the Baltic to Sweden, across the middle of Sweden, interestingly enough, there is a canal called the Göta Canal that connects the west side of Sweden with the east side of Sweden, and I took the boat right through the center of Sweden, and then down the coast of Denmark, from Denmark to Germany, and through Germany to the Netherlands.
Yes.
Netherlands down to Belgium, and Belgium to France, and France to Spain.
Well, I mean, did you have to have a passport, Rennie, when you were going these waterways from country to country?
Well, that's the nice thing about the European Union. Once you've cleared yourself into one European country, you're cleared into all of them.
Oh, okay.
And every country I went through was a member of the European Union. They didn't all use the euro, interestingly enough, but they were. So, no, I didn't have a problem with that. Also, there's an interesting question because there were a lot of places where, particularly in France, where they can get very bureaucratic. And going through these, down these canals and rivers and bays and actually open seas, parts of them, I had locks to contend with. You know, locks raise the water up to meet, et cetera. Probably a little bit, I think I counted a little over 500 locks between,
my goodness,
between Finland and Spain. I know I've gone through over 1,000 locks in my days on the water. So, and I'll tell you, I'm no better at it today than I was going through the first one. I'd say 9 times out of 10, I managed to lock through very cleanly, but that 1 time out of 10 still happens. The wind or the water catches me wrong and bashes me into the side of the lock.
Oh my!
It can be tricky, but
and a lot of waiting time too, isn't it?
Yes, it can be. However, I set off from Finland in the middle of May, which was awfully early in the spring. I mean, where I was in Kotka, Finland, was if you took a latitude line directly across to here, it would be up around Hudson Bay, which is just south of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
So the middle of May, just south of the Arctic Circle, is not the warmest place to be.
Wait.
Anyway, I saw very few other boats on this entire trip because of the season doesn't start in Europe until late June, early July. And I had the locks to myself, and if the lockmaster would see me coming, he'd be all ready for me, and I'd go right in. He'd lift me up 100 feet to the next level, and off I'd go, or drop me down again.
Yeah.
What I was sorry to say about the bureaucracy, because the boat is so small, and it doesn't occur to anybody, and it really never did occur to anybody, that this boat wasn't a local boat.
Mm.
See?
Yeah.
As long as I didn't betray myself with my terrible French and even worse, and non-existent Finnish and non-existent Swedish, then they just thought I was a local boat going through the lock, and they were very, very good about it.
Well, very nice. Now, did you spend most of that period of time? What was it, 3.5 months, Rennie?
3.5 months, yeah.
And did you live on the boat most of the time?
Yes, I did. I spent every single night on that boat.
Well, what did you do for food? Did you fish?
No.
Okay.
Except for crossings that I have to make, you have to cross the sea in order to get from Finland to Sweden, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect Americans to know their European geography that well, but to be able to picture it. But you do, and it's not a great distance, only about 40 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But on a little teeny boat, 40 miles can be harrowing.
Yeah.
At any rate, I forgot. Sorry, what was your question?
What do you do for food? I mean, did a Domino's boat pull up with a little blinking red light and hand you a couple of takeout pizzas? Or, I mean, what do? Do you have to carry the food with you?
No, that's what I have. No, I keep supplies on the boat. I have a food locker, which is full of packaged foods, and I supplement that on a weekly basis, and very often, more often than that.
Yeah,
I lived actually quite well and quite comfortably as long as the weather was above freezing,
yeah,
and the wind wasn't blowing at 40 knots and threatening to capsize my boat and drown me. Those occasions I wasn't too thrilled about. But give me a sunny day and fairly warm weather, which I had by the time I got to France. then the boat suits me very well indeed. I must say, it gives me a new perspective on homeless people in little shacks or cardboard boxes. Basically, that's what I'm doing. But I'll tell you something, David, I didn't mind it. It was fairly comfortable. I'm working all day. I get put in a 12-hour day traveling.
Yeah.
By the time it starts to get dark, by the way, in Finland particularly, there was only 2 hours of darkness. Between 12 o'clock at midnight and about 2 o'clock in the morning, it would be dark. The rest of the time, it was sunshine. So at any rate, I'd be tired at the end of 12 hours of work, and I'd just happy to crawl into my sleeping bag in my little bunk and in that tiny little cabin, just big enough for a sleeping bag and a little stove.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I would cook for myself. I cooked every day for myself. What I started to say, and then to get this out, is because I'm traveling either along the coast, as close inshore as is practical, and I have to be 5 miles offshore, but not usually only a couple hundred yards offshore. So, or I'm on canals, or I'm on rivers. And as you know, whether you're a sailor or not, you think of yourself, you pull into a pier, or even into a marina, if you run across one, and tie up the boat and go in search of a grocery store. And the pizza joint.
What about gasoline? How'd you refuel?
And that's how you ask where the closest gas station is. And I'm a pretty old guy, and I look like an old guy. And I look like I'm not as... So if I ask somebody in my attempt at their language, and by the way, in Scandinavia, as long as you're dealing with people under 30, English is fine. They not only speak English, they speak idiomatic English. And I'd asked a couple of them, how come your English, I'm not surprised that you speak English. I am surprised that your English is so idiomatic. And they said, well, you learn English intensively in high school, but we get our English mostly from videos, movies, and from pop songs.
Our great export from the industrialized world. You're lucky you didn't pull a sitcom skit on you and start doing some shtick or something like that.
Well, I was... when I would turn the radio on, wouldn't matter what country I was in. This summer, the hot song in the U.S. was the same song. It was Call Me Maybe, and it was the same hot song all over Europe. Every country in Europe, that's all they would play, that song, 24 hours a day.
It's interesting how pervasive our cultural exports are.
What?
It's interesting how pervasive our cultural exports are. Do you find that there is a dominant influence from America all across Europe, not just with radio and television, but just basically in cultural attitudes and so forth?
I think the influence goes both ways. I think we are heading towards a global society.
Yeah, I believe you're right, Rennie.
Yeah, I think the internet is the vanguard of that. What that morphs into over the years, I don't know. But I find very little difference in the young people. By the young people, I mean under 25. Between one European country and another, or even with the United States. If you could take a kid out of any of those countries and drop them in the middle of small-town USA, and what the heck? The USA is made up of the kids from those countries. So,
indeed. I'd like to comment on that, Rennie, before we go on with this journey, because you make an interesting point there. The young are always contemporaneous, and they are immediately reflecting wherever we are right now. It's the older generations and the sentinel of generations that seem to hold on to the more traditional values. Yeah. So if we want to see what's happening now, look at the young, and what the you're saying here is that there's perhaps less difference amongst the youths of various countries now than there may have been before. You know, what we've been saying about the cycles of change is that the machine age is over because it's the end of what I call the physical cycle, hundreds of years long, which when high gives us militarism, industrialism, and nationalism. The fences go up in a physical high. Well, that has gone down in our lifetimes and is declining in the world. That means the physical cycle that gave us the Industrial Revolution is now low. So what does that mean? It means walls come down. It means that the boundaries between nations is not as defined. We have a free, fluid exchange of ideas across open boundaries in what was described in one book as the world is flat, and the rising intellectual energies of the world and the rising emotional energies of the world are allowing the quick exchange of thoughts and even expressions of feelings to travel around the world instantly in a twinkling of an eye by virtue of, as you mentioned, the internet. So it is now the pen, or may I say the keyboard, is becoming mightier than the sword, and the swords are being laid down in this changing time. And I just wanted to comment on that, Randy, because you're giving a little bit of support to these notions based on what you recently saw in Europe.
Well, I agree. I agree with what you're saying. I do have a concern, and it's not properly a part of this discussion, but it is a concern over a kind of a new superficiality that I'm beginning to see showing up in the media, and as in the media, you know, it was McLuhan who said that the media is the message. The pundits today argue with that. They say the message is the message. That's a little bit too much for me. I think the media has tremendous influence, a greater influence than even the pundits of the media give it credit for.
Yeah.
But I mean all forms of media, from the internet to television to videos to movies to et cetera. But I think they're tending to shape our culture to a point where when I look around me, I see more and more superficiality.
And
I said it wasn't a proper part of this conversation, so I'm going to get off this subject right now.
Well, you know, you may have a point there, though. I mean, it used to be that Louis Rukeyser was, you know, a financial analyst who used to be on Wall Street Week. Every week, he was a wonderful analyst. And in an interview, I heard him talk about media in terms of reporting. And he said there was used to be three types of news you could get. There was the news, there was commentary, and there was editorial. The news is where someone reports what is happening. A commentary would be when someone gives their ideas on what they think is happening. And an editorial is when the announcer tells you what they believe should be happening. But it was always in the old-time news of those of us who grew up with Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide and John Facenda and so forth. Well, we used to know that they would take a break from the news. If they were going to do a commentary, they would say, and now a commentary or now an editorial by so-and-so. But as Louis Rukeyser went on to say, there is no separation in that. And now it's all enmeshed into one. And so at the same time you're getting news reported to you, you're also getting the views of the reporter who reported to you. And they're reporting their opinions as if they were facts. Now, is that in line with what you've seen? Or what do you mean by superficiality?
What started this off was I was thinking, looking at the new car ads. And I was looking at the new designs of automobiles which are on the road today. And I'm thinking, my God, they look like plastic toys. There is They look like they're designed to last for 2 years max and then be thrown into the junkyard and new and gotten. I mean, our two big expenses that we make in life generally are our automobiles and our houses. And the money that you put into houses now is going into McMansions, these big, huge, superficial-looking edifices with their... In with their 5,000 square feet and two people bouncing around inside that that unused space, and that to me in itself is very superficial. And they also look like these houses look like they are designed to be torn down in another 5 years and some other Mac mansion built on top of them.
Yeah.
So there's an impermanence, and of course, when I was a young fellow, I didn't do this, but what you were supposed to do was to go work for a corporation, mm-hmm. if you were, you know, white middle class, and you had access to corporations in those days. You go work for a corporation and work your way up, and if you were loyal to the corporation would be loyal to you. That's not true anymore. Nobody works for corporations. If they do, they don't expect to be there more than a year or so, and the moment they get hired, they start looking for another job, and they know that that's the way things are going to go. So there's a kind of an inward turning there that I see. That
this is all part of the physical decline, you know. As the this, I'm talking about 336 year cycle in world culture, and now that it is low, it went down, crossed down. From 78 to 1990, it went through a transitional period. The Berlin Wall came down, the Tiananmen Square incident, the Iranian hostage crisis. All this is happening as it shook up to end the high. Castles crumbled, and now it's going low. And what happens when we're in a physical low? Well, the cars look like temporary toys. The houses are McMansions that are, look like big doll houses that are pretty, but they're not really that durable.
No, they're not even pretty.
They're physical.
They're very physical. They're just not well designed. This is a subject that has more to do with my business because I was trained as a writer and a designer, so I'm very sensitive to that, that kind of stuff. At any rate, I'm not meaning, by the way, to suggest that things were better in the old days. I don't think they were.
Uh-huh.
I think they were different in the old days. I mean, I'm finally willing to believe that the world is different today than it was when I was young. That your values are different values today than we have when I was young.
It's a different world because of the cycles of change. And the era that we're going into now is really what we see now are some signs, harbingers of what's going to last throughout this century, throughout the next century, and into the century after that. There are cycles even longer than the one I mentioned. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is why I like your perspective. I mean, going from country to country, seeing it in a different way, traveling. I like to navigate the tides of time, but you are navigating the world.
I tell you, I had an occasion to meet a lot of people, and I found them more alike than unlike.
Interesting.
And I did, I was holed up for about 3 or 4 days in very rough weather in a tiny little pocket harbor called Lund on the Danish coast. And I finally managed to tie off to a pier in this little pocket harbor and make my way ashore. And I was standing in the middle of the road trying to figure out which way I should go, most likely should walk in order to see if I could find a supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And this very attractive-looking woman walked out of her house. And by the way, this road was very narrow, just wide enough for one car, and the little houses along either side of the road were little Tudor houses with thatched roofs. And if you've never seen it, you know what a thatched roof is, but if you've never seen one, they are fabulously intricate kind of monuments to the roof culture. I was just amazed. I mean, they first of all, to see thatched roofs in this day and age. But anyway, so this woman comes out, And she said, "You look lost." And I said, "I'm not lost. I'm trying to figure out where the supermarket might be." And she said, "Well, I'm on, just on my way there to pick up some champagne because it's my husband's birthday. And come on, I'll give you a ride. It's about 5.5 kilometers from here." So off we went, and we picked, and I got some groceries. She got her champagne. And her husband was a diplomat, and quite a well-known diplomat. And the local papers, of which there were three in this very sparsely populated part of Denmark. She had picked up the papers because they had all written kind of short tributes and bios to her husband on honoring his 85th birthday. So anyway, so she on the way back, she said, "You must come in and have a glass of champagne and meet my husband." So I did. A very attractive man, spoke perfect English, much better than I do. Anyway, I mention all of this only because it is how we are more alike than not alike. And she said, "By the way, what's the name of your boat?" I had told her about my, and the boat was down in the harbor at the foot of her hill. And she said, "What's the name of your boat? Does it have a name?" I said, "Yes, it's called Kiss of the Wolf." And she said, "My goodness, that sounds familiar." And I said, "Yes, I stole that from a book by John Irving." And she said, "Of course. Last night at Mystic River." And I said, "You're right. That's the book." Now here I am in the middle of nowhere on the coast, on the rocky coast of Denmark, and here's this woman, admittedly that they are fairly worldly, in this little cottage, who was not only familiar with this particular book, but knew every book that John Irving ever wrote. She was a big fan of John Irving. I was very impressed with that, and I said, "It's."
The more we discover our brothers and sisters around the world, the more that we find that we have common elements. And Jung spoke of the collective unconscious that unites us all. And this is how that we can all move at the same tides of time, that all boats rise when the tides of the culture are moving and fall when they're declining, because there is something that unites us all. Yes, we have our national boundaries and national cycles. The United States has its rhythm, France has theirs, the Russians have theirs. But at the same time, there is much larger cycles lasting hundreds of years that move us all. So we're really all of one mind and one heart and one collective that is moving with the tides of time.
I agree with you on that. I think you're absolutely right on that. And it is well to keep in mind every once in a while that boundaries are purely arbitrary. Every boundary that exists in the world is an arbitrary boundary, with the exception of what separates us from the oceans. And I don't know, and since they were man-made, they could be man-destroyed.
Yes, they can. Yeah, it's our own invention. Rennie, you know, how many miles did you travel, and why did it take 3.5 months to do this journey? Were you on a circuitous route? Did you go off on different ways and you know, feed waters and then come back to the trunk line that you wanted to be on? What was your course on all of this?
Well, first of all, there is no trunk line.
Okay.
Trunk line is you take a big ocean-going boat and you go out into the Baltic, and you sail the Baltic to the Skagerrak, and the Skagerrak to the Adirak, and that to the North Sea, and then over to England, or down to Spain. And it took that long because, as far as miles are concerned, my guess is around 5,000 miles, maybe a little more.
Yeah.
But when you're following rivers and canals, and you're connecting them all up, I mean, I had done a solid month of research to see whether it was even possible to do this.
Yeah.
And when I got to Finland to start off on this trip, I was in nowhere. I would not have taken a bet that I would be able to make it to Spain. I just didn't think that was going to happen. But I was going to try.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, it wasn't all that difficult. No heroics were called for, so So that's why it took 3.5 months. Rivers are not straight lines. They're are canals. And when those 250 locks in France alone are enough to really hold you up for quite a while.
I can imagine.
I thought it was a pretty good time because on a good day I could cover about 50 miles. I mean, I just had a little 10 horsepower outboard motor pushing me along, so you don't go very fast. You know, I'm only traveling at about 6 or 7 miles an hour. That's a fast walk.
But you get to see things and have experiences that you wouldn't have on the QE2. Let's face it.
Oh no, you get to. Oh, you do. You're fabulous. And not only that, you see. Nobody puts billboards pointing at the water. They always point inland. So you don't have billboards. You don't have a good deal of that ugly stuff that we managed to hide the scenery with. Some of it was gorgeous. Particularly the French canals were you find yourself ghosting along. In a canal, which is generally the canals are just wide enough to take two Peniches side by side. A Peniche is a barge that people actually live on these barges. They have a kind of little house erected at the back end of the barge, and then so they're quite narrow, and where you have fields, you have fields or forests, and in the fields you have goats, you have sheep. You have cows and you have horses, and they're always down at the edge of the field where the narrow banks come into the water. And you can be coasting by one afternoon, I was coasting by and I saw this marvelous looking, almost a chateau, a farmhouse, closer to a farmhouse than a chateau, but fairly large. And out in the backyard was a woman of indeterminate age, but she had on one of those big bonnets that you see in Vermeer paintings. This white funnel-shaped bonnet on her head, and she had a seed apron on, an apron that had pockets to carry seed. And she was sowing seed in the courtyard for these chickens.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a Vermeer painting I'm looking at.
And live.
Not only that, to top it off, you could just faintly hear the radio going inside, at least I assumed it was a radio, playing Bach.
Oh, my.
You could have knocked me over with a feather. I just transported back to the 17th century, just like that. And so much of the waterways are no different than they were back in the 17th century. Another interesting thing, and it does separate the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands also from the U.S., something that surprised me is that we're all aware that they use bicycles over there a lot more than we do here.
Uh-huh.
What we don't realize is that the principal mode of transportation in Sweden and Denmark and Finland and the Netherlands is not the car, it is the bicycle. Jeez. And they use bikes not the way we do. We use bikes recreationally. We get on the bike and we go for a little ride. These people, and I'm talking young and old, I'm talking very young and very old, older than me, people in their late 80s and 90s, they're still on their bicycles and they are going always hell-bent for leather. You get on the bicycle and go down to the store and buy your groceries and come back when you go as quickly as you can, as long as you're not passing the speed limit. They are expert bicyclists, and God help you if you are walking and you're on the wrong side of the road because you'll get knocked over by these things. Just amazing.
That's one way to have fuel economy.
Hundreds and hundreds of them. You know, they travel in pelotons. They travel in packs of 20. 20
yes.
or 30. And of course the bicycle paths very often just follow rivers or follow canals, because these be canal mule paths for the canals.
So the machine age didn't quite hit them as hard as it hit the United States, and they're not quite as mechanized. I mean, your local travel was there before the machine age, and it's going to be there now that it's declining. And now that it's declining, we're going into the age of the computer. People are living where they want to live, not where they have to live. Used to be, you had to live near the factory, the big old giant factory that was producing those standardized mechanized widgets that were going out. And so you would live in these row homes all around. But now people are working on the virtual media. They're working from their homes and they can just be anywhere. So as we are, we're becoming more local, more regional. So we might see more of this even happening over here. Hope so.
Well, I don't see the bicycle as being retro. I think they have made a decision that, like solar power and wind turbines, that the bicycle is a more efficient means of transportation in what is basically very flat country. Don't forget, Holland or the Netherlands is totally flat. There are no hills or mountains.
Indeed.
The bicycle is just a more practical means of transportation, actually, than even the car.
Yeah, and it's the most efficient machine we ever developed in terms of output of energy versus input of energy. Hey, folks, you're listening here to the Cycles of Change radio program. We're talking with Rennie Vidmar, who has traveled recently through 15 countries by boat, a boat he built himself and took across the waterways to travel from the border of Russia up by Finland and end up down in the Mediterranean. And Rennie, before the program ends, I do want to talk a little bit about your company. Folks, you can find Rennie's site at rennievidmar.com. Got to spell that for you. Rennie is R-E-N-E Vidmar, V-I-D-M-E-R.com, R-E-N-E-V-I-D MER.com. But before we get to that, Rennie, I got a bit of an esoteric question for you. You know, as you travel that many miles and through that many countries and go from, well, sort of one part of the globe to another, my esoteric question is this. Did you feel a difference in the energy as sometimes when you were one part of Europe versus the other part? I mean, you're on the water, you're not face-to-face interacting with people at this point. Did it just feel like you were somewhere else, despite the immediate surroundings of the trees look different on the shore or whatever? Weird question, I know that.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I know that sometimes if I were, somebody were driving in a car and I were in the back seat and I fell asleep and we went into a totally different region, and I woke up in that back seat, sometimes I would know that I was in a different part of the country before I got up and looked around because I could feel the difference.
Oh, sure. I find that in Spain particularly. I find that people socialize a little differently depending on where they are. So most of my family lives in Spain, so I can be a little bit more critical of Spain than I can of other places. I find the southern Spaniard male is more apt to be macho, which is very macho. And once you get up to northern Spain, you find much less of that macho-ness. In males, and you find much greater equality between the women and the men, or the boys and the girls. Girls are accepted as equals. I don't find that in the south of Spain.
Indeed, yeah, and that's physical energy. I believe you can map the world and say some parts are more physical, more emotional, more intellectual. The places that are more physical are more masculine. The places more emotional are more feminine. And the intellectual bases, well, that doesn't affect masculinity or femininity at all, because it's neither and both. Intelligence is not masculine or feminine. But I find that very interesting, because I believe that we could map out the world in these energies, which explains why there's power shifts around the world. As different energies rise and fall, the physical cycle rise, the physical regions of the world come into preeminence, but power shifts when the cycle changes. And now that the intellectual cycle is rising, power is shifting over to the Orient. You know, because that's why they were the sleeping dragon while the intellectual cycle was low. And that's why I like to ask questions like this to you, because you are traveling, you know, in the depth of, you know, virtually going across all these nations, and you've seen the contrasts. Rennie, let me ask you a little bit about your company. I mean, your company is absolutely astounding in the accomplishments that it had at RennieVidmer.com, R-E-N-E-V-I-D-M-E-R.com. Here we go. We'll use a lingo.
I've been doing this for a long time. So
yes, you have.
Yeah, and I don't know what to tell you about it. It is an attitude. I work with other people who are themselves quite talented. So
yeah, and you had you were working on war games when I first met you many years ago, back in the 1990s. I ran into you in the Hamptons.
Yep.
And war games was really quite the thing at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I spent 10 years writing games, but I burned out on that. You really do. It was I produced six games in that 10 years, or six or seven, and I loved doing it, but it was 12 hours a day. You know, it was real jolt call of time. It was a very geeky thing. I'm not kidding. It was like eating popcorn, writing code. But I had owned a game company, a board game company, years and years ago, which was quite successful.
Yes.
When I did the computer games, it was fine. But I just burnt out. I just, one day after I finished my last game, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I've got to get back to having a life.
Wow, there are times when I'm building websites for hours on end that I would yearn for the sea and have the wind on my face and travel the waves. That's what I would like to do a little bit sometimes, too. Do you have any sojourns planned coming up in the future, Rennie?
There is a canal in France called the Dumidi Canal, which goes all the way from almost just west of Marseille, across France to the Bay of Biscay, and I would like to run that canal because it has been described to me by some people as the most beautiful canal in the world. So,
wow. And you can pretty much go anywhere you want to once you're on the water in France, can't you? I mean, it's canals and rivers everywhere, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. As long as people don't pay too much attention to me.
Just be unassuming with the 15-and-a-half-foot boat that you built.
Yeah. Now, I have had people stop me. I've had officials, particularly at locks in France, say, you have to sign these papers, and we will send you a bill for your using these waterways. And I say, okay. But then they go back and they check their notes and they discover they don't have any provision for a 15-foot boat. You want a 45-footer or a 50-footer, they know what to do. But a 15-footer, they don't know how to handle it. So they get frustrated, and they finally just wave you off as they go on.
Give them the papers back and hand them a quarter.
Yeah, right.
There's a toll and everything. So what would you say is the more valuable learning experience that you have traveling the way that you do across the world's waters, Rennie? That's a philosophical question, isn't it?
That people are, if they are not intimidated, it doesn't seem to matter where I am. If I need help, I get it almost just by wishing for it. I've gotten myself in lots of hot water on the water, metaphorically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody has always showed up when I need them. So I got stuck on the Georgia-Florida line. In the middle of deep, deep forest, two years ago, I got stopped by a 4-foot in diameter tree that had fallen right across the river, and there was no way I was going to get by it.
Oh, my.
And I hadn't seen another human being for about 5 days, and I was right in the middle of deliverance country there. It's very eerie, very eerie. And very little water under me also. Mm. And while I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, I wasn't... around the corner comes a canoe with two guys in their 20s. And they see my predicament. And they of course, they can just drag their canoe across. Just right. My yeah. boat, even though it's only 15 feet, is heavy. And they took a look at the situation and said, we'll be back in about half an hour. And sure enough, they came back with axes and they chopped that tree down and got me through.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they were real backwoods boys. I said, I will write this up in my report. Let me send it to you. What's your email address? And they both looked at me. And I said, do you have an email address? And one of them said, what's an email address? Do you believe that in this day and age?
That's surprising, yeah.
No idea what an email is. I said, you don't have a computer? He says, no, we don't have a computer. Are you kidding?
No, but he had a lot of heart and good muscle. So
are you saying
that wherever you go, you find the innate goodness in people, Rennie?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I find it. I was in another spot in the Florida Keys. I had was inside a harbor, but there was a shell mound there, and I had gone aground and right in the middle of the harbor. It wasn't marked, but I was slowly drifting off of it. But I saw this guy with a long reddish beard and really a wiry old guy jumps off of his very pretty schooner into his little nutshell pram of a boat and starts rowing towards me. And he comes up and he says, can I give you a hand? Can I tow you off there? And I said, no, it's okay. I can just drift off.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, I need to know about this place. And I see a bar on the other side of the harbor there. If you'll meet me there at 5 o'clock, I'll buy you a beer and pick your brains. So I did. I met him there at the bar, and I said, that was very kind of you.
Yeah.
To offer me help. And I said, this always happens to me, and I think that there's something about this frail old man that brings out the altruism in people. And he said to me, I'll never forget this, he said to me, it's not you, it's the boat. Because the boat is very interesting looking.
Yes.
Not you, it's the boat that brings people out. And I'm sure he's right.
Well, you know, maybe people can identify and live vicariously with what you're doing. You know, when you're on a journey, you're traveling and finding different parts of the world. But I find it very reassuring to know that there are common elements to people everywhere and that innate goodness can be found in everyone everywhere. These are basic human values that are common to us all. And the common threads of us all are something that I find reinforced time and time again as I research different cultures of different regions in different times, that we are all possessing, you know, we all have the same RAM connected to the same internet, only it's not on our computers, it's in our minds and our hearts and our souls. There is a cosmic internet to which we're all connected. Each one of us like a walking laptop that's tied into this great source, and the source is beyond this galaxy and even more. Pardon me for being philosophical, but...
why not? It's an open-ended discussion anyway. Are you a subscriber to the Gaia Principle?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that the Earth is alive, and it is, and it's appropriate that we identify it with a goddess because Mother Earth does have a nurturing energy to it. Absolutely, Rennie. And anything that's alive has a heartbeat, and whenever there's a heartbeat, there is rhythm, and it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And our universe moves. It's got rhythm. And the earth moves with rhythm, and we can find out what these cycles are. And that's what my basis of work is about. And that's why I find that your in-depth travels to go from region to region, culture to culture, to find the in-depth basic nature of people is basically what we're looking at when we're looking at the reality. It's a virtual movement, undulating rhythms that change the tides of time and give us our different epochs of history. So, I mean, if there's tides on the oceans as it is in the physical world, so it is in the non-physical world, and the dynamic influence on us has tides as well. How's that for a segue?
I like it.
Okay. Well, do you still have the boat, Rennie?
Huh?
Do you still have the boat?
Oh, yeah, the boat is, I hauled her in halfway down Spain, just below Barcelona, and had one of my nephews-in-law come down with a trailer, pick us up, and take me up just north of Madrid, and she's sitting in the edge of my sister's soccer field. They have a compound there north of Madrid, and she's sitting there on blocks waiting for me to come back next spring and get her fixed up and take her back up into France.
My goodness, we've looked ahead on what travels you may be on with these amazing sojourns you're on, and we mentioned your site. Are you embarking upon any programming adventures at this time, or do you have your sights set on, repeating some of the amazing results that you have had across your career?
Well, I have my current clients, it's just business. I'm just helping. I advertise myself as a communications consultant,
yes,
which in itself doesn't mean much, but it just means I'm a good art director, I'm a good designer, I'm a fair writer. Usually I work with other writers. But
yes,
right now I have working on a project to introduce to market a stool, actually. It's hard to explain. It's a stool which was designed, which is being shown in the Museum of Modern Art, and it's been so successful that it is, it's a new way of sitting. I don't want to get into it. It's very difficult to describe. Here I am, a communications consultant, and I can't even describe this product. Anyway, I'm working with the manufacturers to package it, to advertise it, to promote it on a general market.
Indeed, and I wouldn't be surprised if this new way of sitting has some ergonomic values for us, because, you know, there's a lot of studies that are coming out now that are finding that one of the hardest things that you can do on your body is be sitting too long, and it's a lack of physical activity, and they're finding all different particular problems that are happening. This is more of a syndrome now as we're moving into the information age, and just getting up, they say you got to get up at least every 2 hours and move around. And so if we learn better ways to sit in between those times for those intellectuals in the world, it would be a tremendous value.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what this is. It's called a stoolie. It's a rocking stool, and it's very interesting. It's designed for the workplace. I really don't want to get into it. It's in its very early stages right now, and I don't know what my client wants me to reveal on it.
Well, that's fine, and you are a man of discretion as well as a man of invention. Rennie, if people wanted to contact you with any questions about what you've done, what you do, or what you might do for them, how would you advise them to get in touch with you?
Get in touch with me via my one of several email addresses, Rene at renevidmer.com. That's as simple as that.
Okay. And folks, I'm going to spell that for you one more time, renevidmer.com, RENEVIDMER.com. We're wrapping up here. We're in the final minute or so of the Cycles of Change radio program here on December 6, 2012, talking with Rennie Vidmar and another one of his amazing sojourns across 15 countries in Europe in a 15-and-a-half-foot boat, reflecting on the amazing accomplishments of multiple awards of his company and how you can contact him at RennieVidmar.com. Rennie, I want to thank you for sharing your wisdom, your experience, and a little bit of your journey with us here tonight on the Cycles of Change radio.
Well, David, I want to thank you for inviting me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope to do it again sometime when I've got something interesting to report.
as you often do, and I look forward to us talking about your next sojourn, hopefully in the beautiful countryside of France. Folks, thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with Rennie, RENEVIDMER.com, find out about him. He is a man of many wonders, and we're thankful to talk with him tonight. Signing out, Cycles of Change radio program, David Katzmeyer here for the Cycles of Change. Thank you for listening.